Yeah, there we go. Yeah, the it's just one of the requirements. We're sort of setting, you know, we're not just going to be writing the report and putting things on the web, but we're also sort of creating a record for posterity so that future scholars can go back and, you know, retread this ground. And sure. Certainly we're finding plenty of material for future scholars to look at as well. But I need to add, well, first of all, I just need to say, you know, a couple things for the record. This is Kirsten Downey with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. It is October 15th, and it is about 5:38 my time, and I'm speaking with Prentice Cox. And could you please consent to be recorded?
Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start this out by myself here today, and then it may be that a few other people from our staff will join us. You know how it is on Friday afternoons.
Sure.
But please, let's start. Could you tell me a little bit about your own background? And then I'd like to sort of go into the whole AmeriQuest saga.
I went to University of Minnesota Law School here, graduating in 1990. I worked for a judge in the Northern District of Illinois, federal judicial clerk, and then I spent 15 years at the roughly at the Minnesota Attorney General's office. Most of that time in the consumer enforcement or consumer protection division. Division that I managed from 2001 to 2005. And while I was there, I was involved in a series of suits against subprime mortgage lenders and basically worked with many other state AGs on those cases.
Okay. Now, you said you start, what was the first case that you worked on? What was the
The first subprime mortgage case? The first subprime mortgage case I worked on was First Alliance Mortgage Company. And I remember the almost exact dates. I'd say it was somewhere around August of 1998. Somewhere in there, the head of our consumer services division, which deals with the people who call in with complaints and that kind of thing, came to our office with a complaint about fees that totaled 20% of the amount of the loan for a mortgage. And I said, no, that's a typo. You know, this is back in the days of bad faxes. You know? I said, it's a typo. You know, get the original documents. It's probably just 2%. Nobody charges 20%. And that was kind of my introduction to subprime mortgage lending.
Once
we confirmed that it was really 20%, I actually thought that was just so unbelievable. And then I, you know, looked at the documents and I realized this person had a teaser rate arm, and I had them call and confirm, you know, that they understood that, and they had no clue that it was a teaser rate arm. So I actually sent my crack investigator, used to be a real estate agent, down to the county courthouse, and I just said, pull every loan from this company until you get to about 12. And, you know, call the first two or three borrowers and ask them about the terms of their loan. If you can, get their documents. It's a little intrusive, but I just want to make sure this wasn't like a standard practice of this company.
Right.
Sure enough, it was. And every borrower she talked to had no clue how much they'd been charged. They all had teaser rate arms. They had no clue they had teaser rate arms. And so we just kept going from there.
So when you said that teaser rate, how did it work? Do you remember?
Sure. In fact, I remember in detail. They had an initial rate, and that rate would go up every 6 months by a maximum of 1%. And it was set below, if you added up the index plus the base rate, it actually exceeded their current rate, so that made it a teaser rate, meaning that if interest rates stayed the same, if they didn't change at all, their rates were going to go up for the first three adjustments. you know, if interest rates stayed the same. So they actually were given a rate that wasn't the, quote, real rate, because the index plus margin exceeded that that initial rate. Does that make sense?
Is yes.
The description of a Deezer rate.
But yes, yes.
And the average Deezer rate, as I recall, well, I have it in documents, if I recall it is over 2%. So that, you know, they would have a 1% adjustment in 6 months, another 1% increase in the next 6 months, assuming rates didn't go down, and then another partial increase the next 6 months. And that, if rates went up, they'd keep getting, you know, it could go as high as, I think it could keep going up for a few years if the rates rose.
What kind of loans did people have? Did they know at all?
No, almost, it was shocking. People had no clue. They had no clue they had adjustable rate loans. They had no clue they had a teaser rate on the adjustable rate loans. They had no clue they had paid 20%. They just didn't know. Now, we did start to get, after that first complaint, we did start to get some complaints. So people discovered this. And I think when we really did this we were the last state that they came into and at the time we sued them. So they had just come into our state, just I think within a year, probably less. I think that started in late 97, early 98, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
And, we were, a very recent expansion for them. And so we were the first state to sue them and the last state they'd come into. So we jumped on it in regulatory time. We jumped on it fairly quickly.
Yes. So when did... So you sued them?
Yes, we did.
And what was the resolution?
November of 1998, with seeking a temporary injunction.
Uh huh. To get them to desist.
Well, we asked for a fairly draconian temporary injunction. We didn't get everything we asked for, but we essentially asked them to stop making these kinds of loans, but the judge didn't give us that.
Okay. And what was the final resolution in this case?
We wound up settling the case in 1999, I want to say, I think it was 99,
mm-hmm.
Maybe early 2000 by the time we signed the papers.
Okay.
We wound up settling the case for a variety of reasons, some of which I can't go into. We got back either $4,000 or $6,000 per borrower. And we were very lucky to have TCF Mortgage, a local bank, TCF Bank,
mm-hmm.
Agree to rewrite mortgages for people.
Okay.
So they read about this. It was interesting. This is just a side note.
Yeah.
But the reporter working on the case, Neil Gendler, because I'd worked with Neil on other consumer protection stories at the Minneapolis paper, the Star and Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
Neil, got this case when we first filed it as a complaint, and he thought, this is outrageous. He thought it was and I had the same reaction. I'm like, this is amazing. These people just got barbecued.
Right.
And their sales pitch is so incredibly deceptive. And he had the same reaction. And I kind of reverse engineered the whole sales pitch and written a rather long complaint about how they deceived everybody and temporary injunction went into tremendous detail. And we were able, their first salesperson in the office had a crisis of conscience, and he was an auto F&I guy, meaning he sold the finance and insurance and, that kind of junk at the, what's called the back end of the auto transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is not an industry characterized by, frequent visits to the clergy for beatification. I mean, these guys had a pretty long history of fairly shady practices, and the guy that Framco hired out of this field had a crisis of conscience and came to us about the time we were ready to file the lawsuit. And so I knew that when I had an auto F&I guy in my office with a crisis of conscience, that's when you have a good consumer protection case.
Yes.
And his name was Greg Walling, and he was great. And he basically confirmed everything that we knew, and then added a whole bunch of detail and gave us a very long affidavit, which he painstakingly pored over, was a great witness, and got it, tried to get it exactly right. And he did an amazing job of, you know, helping us with, you know, putting together the case. So we filed the entire case, and then we settled, and then TCF Bank helped us rewrite the individual loans. Again, because we got in so quickly, it wasn't too bad. We didn't have thousands of loans. I think there was only like 100 and something loans.
Right.
Yeah. So.
I've just been joined by a colleague here, and Alexis, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Alexis Simmendinger, and I'm working with Kirsten as part of the FCIC writing team.
Hi, glad to meet you.
So you wrapped up FAMCO, and then what happened?
And again, if you want any documents, I can probably send you the settlement and the complaint and the TI memo and the settlement.
That'd be great.
You know, if you just let me know what you want.
Okay.
And then what happened? Well, what happened is I had a job, and I had 10,000 consumer protection suits to consider and take on. And not the least of which was were these cases arising out of our U.S. Bancorp case, which was what led to Title V of the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which was the sharing of personal financial information to telemarketers. And that whole industry of what, you know, I wound up calling pre-acquired account marketing. So we did a lot of that work, which is tangentially related to what you're doing. But then we had, you know, 1,000 different suits. And the next thing that happened was I joined, for internal reasons to my office, I couldn't join when they first formed the case against Household. If we're now just talking about subprime mortgage lending, right?
I guess we're talking about mortgage lending generally, but I really, I'm particularly interested in AmeriQuest. But go ahead with Household, right?
Take you through Household real quickly.
Okay.
So I got into the Household case, and the people I had worked with in FAMCO were also in the leadership at Household on the Household case, and were people I'd worked with in other cases. So even though I was a little late, I got into the Household case and was appointed to the executive committee to sort of negotiate with Household. So I was one of, like, I don't know, three assistant attorney generals, and it was led by Tom Miller, the attorney general of Iowa, had Roy Cooper, the attorney general of North Carolina, and the banking commissioner from New York was kind of the executive sort of negotiating group, and so I helped negotiate that $485 million restitution, $525 million settlement with $484 million and $525 total million settlement with Household. Mm-hmm. And I think Kathleen Keese, do you know Kathleen?
Just by name.
Yeah, Kathleen's amazing. You have to talk to Kathleen.
Okay.
Kathleen was at the time at the Iowa Attorney General's office, and then we, you know, had a long period after we agreed on the money where we wrote this, I think it was 30-page injunctive provisions about how they were going to operate, and Kathleen really took the lead on a lot of that and did just an extraordinary job. She's now at the Center for Responsible Lending, although she's back living in Des Moines.
Right. I'm sorry, you said that was Tom Miller from Iowa.
Yep.
Roy Cooper from, did you say North Carolina?
North Carolina.
And the New York Banking.
I can't remember, it was a woman, and I don't remember her name, who was the New York State Banking Commissioner.
Right.
And then there was me and Tom James. Oh, and I'm sorry, also Christine Gregoire, who was the State of Washington Attorney General. And there was me and Tom James from Illinois Attorney General's office, and me from the Minnesota Attorney General's office, and I'm trying to think who else was on that group. I want to say Chuck Cross from the Washington DFI, the Washington State Financial Regulator.
Uh-huh.
So I think that was the group. But anyway, Tom James, me, Chuck Cross had all worked together on the FAMCO case. We all had a big hand in FAMCO. And then we all reunited on this Household case with these folks that I mentioned taking, you know, leadership.
Yes.
The actual politicians and elected officials and appointed officials. But, you know, we were kind of the staff on that, along with Dave Huey from the state of Washington, and Kathleen Keith doing the from Iowa Attorney General. So that was kind of a core group of us. And then after the household case, if you read Mike Hudson's book, who's writing about this exact thing, it's coming out in 11 days. I had an advance copy that he sent me one. If you read Mike's book, he goes into detail about all this stuff. And he gets one fact wrong, which I'm going to tell you. So mm-hmm. while you're recording this for posterity, if somebody comes back in 200 years.
Okay.
Mike's book got one fact wrong. At the end of the household case,
right.
I'm going to get you to AmeriQuest, which is where you want to go.
Okay.
At the end of the household case, I passed a note to Tom James. It will say in the book Tom Miller, and it was significant because it was Tom Miller for blah, blah, blah reasons. Well, that's all wrong. The only thing Mike got wrong as far as I know.
Okay.
And so I passed a note to Tom James. We were all exhausted. We had just agreed on the, you know, $500 million settlement, and we were all exhausted, and I just passed the kind of in fun. I passed a note to Tom James saying, who's next? And Tom James looked at it thoughtfully for like 2 or 3 minutes, and then he wrote on there AmeriQuest. He passed it back to me.
Yes.
And I said, yeah, I kind of shook my head. Yeah, that sounds about right. So, I mean, what's true is it's like, you know, when we sued Famco, I bet they were the largest subprime one.
Right.
But I don't know that for sure. I do know for sure that Household was the largest when we went after them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we settled with Household and they had to comply with the injunction, their origination fell drastically. And AmeriQuest became, and then AmeriQuest volume kept rising and rising, and they became the largest lender, and we went after them. I mean, the truth is, we could have gone, you know, we could have thrown a stone. It didn't matter. By that point, you kind of got the idea that the subprime industry was, you know, literally just one big fraud factory. And so passing the note to Tom was just sort of like, well, who's next? And that's exactly what happened, is after we settled this case in December of 2002, the finishing touches were put on. And then in 2003, we started to meet as a group and basically say, well, who's next? And we looked at two different targets. We looked at Wells Fargo Financial, and we looked at AmeriQuest. And I believe Iowa, no, maybe it was Chuck Cross in Washington. Or Dave Huey in Washington, we're at the AGs. We're looking at Wells Fargo Financial, one of those. And I was looking at AmeriQuest, and we kind of hashed it out within the group and decided AmeriQuest was the better case for a variety of reasons. So we were getting ready to send a civil investigative demand to AmeriQuest, and AmeriQuest general counsel, remember the guy I told you brought me the 20%, the loan with the 20% charge from Famco?
Right.
Back in mid-1998?
Right.
Yeah, his name was Kurt Lowe. And Kurt Lowe had left the office, and the Attorney General's office we had, and he started he started working as a mortgage broker, and he actually...
What?
Yeah, he was good. I mean, he had good mortgage brokers. You know, that's the industry he knew, you know. So he went out to be a mortgage broker and was good at it, actually. I refinanced my home with him.
And you flipped him.
You know, he was a good guy, you know. So he was a good mortgage broker. So anyway, so he went to do that. But he also consulted. And he had this little consulting practice. So he became a consultant for AmeriQuest. And AmeriQuest hired Kurt. In fact, you could call Kurt. I think with AmeriQuest dead, he could probably just talk to you. You want his number?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little one-off, but it might be a very interesting conversation. So Kurt becomes this, like, consultant for AmeriQuest.
Uh-huh.
And he calls me up out of the blue. Either that or I'm cynical enough to think somehow they found out about our group and that I was the leader of it. And so he calls me up and says, well, you know, AmeriQuest general counsel, a guy named Tom Noto, is going around the country talking to AGs to make sure they're in compliance. And I'm like, yeah, never hurts to talk. Bring them in. Good timing, Kurt. You know, I won't tell you much more than just say it's good timing. So why don't you have him come in? So Tom Noto comes to my office and gives me the dog and pony show. complete with the best practices. And, you know, after you've been in consumer protection work with the AG for a while, you know, best practices is another way of saying we've got problems and this is our PR solution to it. So you can pretty much just throw those in the trash can. You know, thank you for that fascinating presentation is sort of the, you know, approach to someone coming in with their best practices.
Uh-huh.
None of which addressed what we had identified as the problem. And so we have this, you know, so Noto comes in and I say, well, will you accept a voluntary request for information? So the group put together, and I sent out under my signature a list of states that were participating. And I don't remember how many it was. It's probably just 8 or 9 or 10 in this request. And we were requesting information. And the most important, you know, we got a few boxes of data. I don't, a few boxes of documents, maybe 10 or something, which isn't an overwhelmingly large number for this kind of work, as you guys no doubt know.
Mm-hmm.
But most importantly, we got a data dump. So we basically just said, you know, give us all these fields. If you don't have these fields, tell us what you do just like this.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave them a huge list of fields, probably 30, 35 fields of data. And, you know, they produced. They, you know, I don't know that we got everything, but it seemed to be a good face. You know, on the scale of productions, it was a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they produced a tremendous amount of data for us and documents. And, you know, we were able to sort through that.
What was
putting
the date?
To get,
what was the date of this, the document production?
It was, it's really funny. You would think I'd have a better rank. Like, I knew every month what happened in FAMCO, and that's older and household. I believe in AmeriQuest we asked for this data at the very beginning of 2004.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been in 2003.
Do you remember when you first started hearing about AmeriQuest cases in Minnesota?
2002, in there. I generally sort of tracked all the consumer complaints about mortgage companies just because I was especially interested in that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And subprime. So, you know, I would generally have a handle on who had the large number of complaints among mortgage companies, and AmeriQuest hit the radar around 2001, probably.
Can I ask you a question related to when you were reviewing Wells Fargo Financial and AmeriQuest and thinking target-wise, and you said that you chose AmeriQuest for a variety of reasons. From our vantage point at the FCIC, were any of those reasons things that we should just keep in mind as we're thinking about AmeriQuest?
Yeah, the complaints were more severe.
Okay.
You know, they were more odd, to be perfectly honest. I mean, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. And here's what we identified as some of the issues when we went after AmeriQuest and we asked them for data on. There's this whole set of, I would call, standard subprime deception problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they involve the costs, the points, the prepayment penalties, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all those standard complaints about all those standard things. I went to refinance my AmeriQuest loan. I got hit with a $3,000 prepayment penalty. I had no idea it was there. You know, this is standard subprime problem. But with AmeriQuest, the things that jumped out at you were, I had maybe 8 or 9 complaints about inflated appraisals. Well, what an odd thing for a borrower to complain about.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I'm like, inflated appraisals? You know, who is going to complain about an inflated appraisal?
Yes.
You know, that means, one, they had no clue that the appraisal was inflated, right? And likely. And more importantly, it's not the kind of it's not the kind of thing that a borrower would naturally latch on to when things go sour.
Uh-huh.
So if there were that many complaints about it, I've never seen a complaint about an inflated appraisal that I could recall.
Yes.
And I was like, if I have 8 complaints from borrowers about inflated appraisals, they must have a pretty standard business practice of inflating the appraisals here.
Right.
The borrowers were afraid that the inflated appraisals were going to affect them in some way, or they were just appalled as consumers, or what?
No. That's more of somebody who's never been in distress asking the question. No, these were people who couldn't make their payments, and they went to sell their house.
I see. Okay.
And they thought their house was worth $290,000, and it was worth $210,000.
I see.
And
okay.
This is in a market that's rapidly rising every year.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. I understand now. Thank you.
So they couldn't sell their house for what their mortgage was worth in a time when everyone knew that home prices were inflating rapidly.
I see.
Right.
Yeah. So that's an odd complaint. So I'm like, whoa, put a star by that one, and what does that mean? And then the other thing we get is we're getting these complaints, and this is the same odd issue. We're getting these complaints about they told me to say that I was a consultant or a babysitter or did light construction on this and had this business or antique dealer, and I had this business that made all this money. And I'm like, okay, so you committed mortgage fraud. And again, why would a borrower tell you they committed mortgage fraud, right? Because they had no clue they were committing mortgage fraud. Because they were told this is standard practice, this is how you do it. And they were being qualified for loans they weren't really, that they could never pass real underwriting.
Okay.
So when we asked for data from AmeriQuest, we actually highlighted inflated appraisals, stated income loans, as well as this standard, list of subprime cost rate problems. So we got the data back and we analyzed it. And what was striking about this, and I got this finally, because when I started with FAMCO, I knew that Lehman Brothers was lurking back there, but I didn't really get it,
Yeah.
I didn't really get that. And I even had a colleague who was one of the people who, Tom Purcell, who was one of the movers and shakers who created the tobacco lawsuit. And so I go to Tom because he was the best thinker in the office at the time I started this suit when Skip Humphrey was still the Attorney General. And I said, I got this amazing case where these people just, barbecued these mortgage borrowers. And I remember Tom telling me, well, where do they get their financing? I said, I don't know. I kind of have some sense it's like Wall Street financing. It's not a bank. So it's not a depository institution. I think they have some Wall Street. And then I later got that it was Lehman Brothers was in the background with these guys. And he said, well, look upstream. And I'm like, well, I'm overwhelmed just putting together the scam, It's like that just seemed a little overwhelming to me. Now, in retrospect, Tom was being brilliant because he was intuiting just from my discussion with him that, the connection between the origination and the funding, But by the time we did household, what I got, partway through being involved in the household case, I got it. I got that household lived on these Wall Street lines of credit, and people were talking about settling for half of what we ultimately settled for, and I was like a super hawk by the end of the case, even though I didn't go in that way. I'm like, these guys have to settle with us. And I kind of understood this connection between they live on this margin between what they can borrow from Wall Street and what they can lend at, and if we don't settle with these guys and we sue these guys, Wall Street's going to flip, right?
Right.
So we have this leverage because they're dependent upon this money coming out of Wall Street, and that our suits are going to impact Wall Street's willingness to loan money to these guys. And so I finally, I got that connection. All right. So by the household case, I understood that connection. When I got back the data and we analyzed it from AmeriQuest. And this is 2004, right?
Mm-hmm.
In 2004, Probably, I'm guessing spring 2004, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, you could eventually dig up documents from an AG's office or find someone who's still in an AG's office who has better records. Dave Huey at Washington Attorney General's office would be a great source if you're just looking for time. Huey, H-U-E-Y. Chuck Cross, who is amazing. And Dave and Chuck and I went through all these cases together, particularly Chuck and I. Chuck is in Washington, D.C. He moved over recently to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He's going to be help set that up. And Chuck and Dave might have documents from and remember timelines better. So they would be great sources. The other source I'll give you is my buddy Tom James at the Illinois Attorney General's office. After all these years, I can still remember Tom's number. Looking at it.
Yep.
That we were this core group that carried through all these cases, okay? And had fun, actually, as well, you know, kind of doing it at the same time we were appalled. But by AmeriQuest, here's the point, and I know I'm rambling. But
no, that's okay. This is great.
By the time we got to AmeriQuest and we got that data back, I know I got, and you'll have to talk to them, but I got that it had shifted, that the lending pattern had shifted. When we started out with Samco, this was an unconscionably high charges to borrowers, a chunk of whom were A credit, right? It's just unbelievable. This is where you want the civil death penalty. I mean, they were charging these 20% teaser rate, exploding teaser rate loans to people with A credit. It's just unconscionable. The household was about high cost lending with bad seconds and, you know, but the costs had come down, but they were still quite high. And again, you know, somewhat imprudent, but mostly it was about the costs and the deceptions and the prepayments and all the either front-loaded or back-loaded costs on these loans. With AmeriQuest, the lending had shifted. The costs were still there, but they had come down even farther. You still had ARMs, but now they were structured as these 228 ARMs, sometimes 327s. You guys know what those are, right?
Yes, right.
Okay. So, you know, then you start seeing these 228s all over, and you immediately, when you looked at the spreadsheet, you could see they had begun to shift from 01, 02, 03. They were shifting more and more toward these 228 ones.
When would you say that? When would you say that period was between 2001 and 2003?
Yeah.
They shifted to these two. Okay, these non-traditional loans are coming in.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, they started shifting to the 228s because they could sell the teaser rate,
yes.
The 2-year rate, right? You know, so they were able to sell the low rate. And they were able to qualify people, which is astounding. I mean, think about that. They were underwriting to the teaser rate. It's unbelievable. You know, how stupid can you get? And so they started to underwrite to the teaser rate. They started to see the 228 loans. But here's what else you start to see. You start to see these inflated appraisals. You saw these no-doc and low-doc loans, these stated income loans. We saw this pattern of them having the same professions listed on different people's stated income loans, weird professions like antique dealers. I think we found a guy in California who was a blind guy who was an architect. We had a blind guy in Minnesota doing, you know, some other thing a blind guy couldn't do. I had an old couple in southern Minnesota. She was like in her 70s. He was in his 80s with a walker, and he was doing light construction. She was cleaning houses.
Wait. Tell me that again. Wait, an old couple. Where were they?
Yeah.
Where were they?
He was like in his 80s. She was with a walker, you know, one of those little walkers. And she was in her 70s taking care of him. And he was supposedly making, you know, X dollars a month doing light construction.
But what town were they in?
It was southern Minnesota.
Okay.
It was southern Minnesota. I don't remember where.
And you didn't believe this. I'm kidding.
No. Well, I mean, we actually called people, you know, and like got these backstories. But you didn't even need to do that. If you looked at the file, you could see they were doing things like you would see antique dealer over and over again.
So they were creative but repetitive.
Repetitive, yeah. I mean, it was obvious. And, you know, you got on the line, each state would analyze their own state's files. And you get on the line and say, okay, look for your, you know, look at these stated income loans and identify what the occupation is. And the next call we'd all get on and it would be, yep, antique dealer, architect. I mean, it was the same profession. They were, I mean, it wasn't even, it didn't take, like, you know, it didn't take Sherlock Holmes to figure out that this was bogus, right? So, you know, what had happened, and this was pretty quickly apparent to me, is that we were dealing with a new kind of subprime problem here. And it was actually a little bit of a problem with the case that we had in front of us. Because what we were used to was using UDAP laws. Is that a familiar term to you guys?
Tell me what that is.
Unfair Deceptive
Acts. Yes, okay, right.
Laws, our state consumer fraud laws.
Uh-huh.
We were used to using our UDAP laws as our primary hammer. And so when he had the FAMCO case, you know, perfect fit, right?
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, they were deceiving people. But by the time we got to AmeriQuest, what had happened is the deception problem was still there. People were deceived, but really, the real underlying problem, and we talked very expressly about this, the real underlying problem was that this was two things. One, this was just massively imprudent lending. And they were convincing, and the fraud, we talked to the former employees. One of the pieces of data we got was former employees, so we started calling former employees all across the country. And I remember Tom Miller was like a little skeptical about this case because he was, you know, his view was, well, inflated appraisals, that's not really a UDAP problem. You know, there's nothing. And then we started calling the former employees, and the former employees in Des Moines were telling him, you know, were telling his staff that they were running a boiler room, basically. And so the former employees started to really fill us in on what was going on, and you began to see this massive fraud, and you began to hear about the things that later came out, like these W-2s that got changed to qualify people by, you know, whiting it out and writing in a new income, you know, and things like that. And so you began to get a sense of the level of fraud. But there was a little disconnect between what was happening and our primary tool and perspective.
Yes.
And we were used to using our UDAP laws. But a lot of this stuff, while it was fraud, and while it was fraud with involving the borrower, it was also fraud against the companies that were buying these loans, right?
Right.
Right. So then you began to really see this connection between the funding and securitization system and what was going on with the origination.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I think, you know, when Mike Hudson wrote his book, you know, Chuck Cross and I come off as heroes. But the truth is, I did get it. In 2005, before I came here in summer of 2005 to the U,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in the first 6 months of 2000, first 5 months of 2005, when we were talking about going out to L.A. or Orange County and having settlement negotiations and that kind of thing with AmeriQuest, and it was apparent there was kind of a split in the group, and I was leading the Hawks, and you know, my perspective was, we have to stop the subprime mortgage industry. This is an industry utterly out of control.
Just a second. Just a minute, please.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. You know, and by that point, I mean, I'm a little slow. This is 6.5 years after I first started looking at subprime cases, right?
Yes.
But, you know, by that point, it was just apparent that that the industry was literally out of control. And I mentioned two factors. One is, you know, this rampant fraud, this imprudence in lending. It wasn't just the deception. It had moved into this, you know, imprudent lending. But the second was the volume. I mean, when I first did that FAMCO case, even though we were the last state they came into, we only had like 100 loans or something, you know. And they spent like 2 and 3 hours per borrower doing the sales presentation. It was a low volume, high high margin business, right?
Yeah.
You know, not low volume, but not huge volume. Ameriquest was just massive quantities of loans. You just saw the explosion on the spreadsheet when you started looking at the numbers from 2000 to 2001, to 2002, 2003, 2004. You just saw this massive explosion in loan volume, and the numbers were astounding, you know? So you put those things together, and it's like, so we have this incredibly imprudent lending, and all you had to do was pick up the loan files. And so, you know, I remember during the Ameriquest case and years after, you know, you get these, until the crash, until it became obvious in mid-07, late 07 that the industry was collapsing, you know, people would say, well, you know, there's no evidence of this and that. I'm saying, it's so easy. And I remember saying during the Ameriquest case, you know, we had all these former ACs lined up, and they would defend all the lending. I said, have you ever gone and randomly picked out 10 mortgage files from this company and read them?
Just a second.
Shoot, we're just writing.
That's okay.
We're
slow. And they said, no. And I said, do it. Come back and talk to me after you've gone and randomly picked out 10 mortgages and just look at the paper. I mean, no, more or less call the borrowers and find out what the reality is under it. That'll really blow your mind. But just look at the paper. I mean, all you had to do was randomly pick out 10 files, and two or three of them are just going to jump right off the page at you. I mean, an example, the very first Ameriquest file I picked up when we got our response from our production, just random file, not complainants, not people who were complaining, just a random file. It involved an appraisal, and the appraisal was for like a mid-ring suburb in the west side of Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, middle to upper middle class area in what's called Plymouth. And to get an appraisal, they had gone out to the exclusive area, maybe 10 miles west of there, on what's called Lake Minnetonka, this giant series of lakes, really. They'd gone out there to get a comparable. And, I mean, they'd skipped over, you know, entire suburbs to get a comparable. You didn't
Yes.
need to do that, obviously. That's absurd.
And when you say that, you're talking about both Ameriquest and the appraisers they were using.
I'm talking about the appraisal that was in the Ameriquest file.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's the equivalent of, you know, somebody coming in from, you know, Rockville, Maryland, refinancing their home, and their comparable is in Chevy Chase.
Right.
Right?
Right?
I mean, you know,
right.
No.
So does this mean...
It's just obvious if you know the answer.
I'm just asking of the ties between the appraisers and Ameriquest themselves. You know, I'm just making
right.
sure that you're saying that there was no question in your mind that Ameriquest knew and the appraisers knew and this was all very purposeful.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there's no question. I mean, it's like you don't do an appraisal like that
mm-hmm.
unless you're trying to inflate the number.
Mm-hmm. Were the borrowers buying the properties at these inflated prices?
You know, again, it's not mostly a purchase market.
Uh-huh.
It's mostly a refinance.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and that's important to remember because that's where the story, a lot of this story has been reinvented. And one of the reinventions is, oh, the typical borrower was buying more home than they could afford. It's like, no. The typical borrower was being aggressively solicited to refinance their loan at a lower overall monthly interest rate by wrapping in either their medical or credit card debt.
So
And to support that loan, you had to have a higher appraisal number and you had to have enough income, so they were inventing higher appraisal numbers and they were inventing income.
By wrapping in, you said their medical bills or what else?
The standard solicitation was their credit card or debt or their medical debt,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
And they were paying these off at very high interest rates. So Ameriquest could come in and refi them, finance them at a subprime mortgage interest rate and lower their overall monthly payment. Of course, they weren't telling people or highlighting for people that they were substituting dischargeable debt and bankruptcy for debt secured by their home. You know, that, of course, was the tragedy.
Right.
But, you know, here's the point.
Can I ask you one question?
Yeah. No,
when you were talking about FAMCO and you saw the ramp up in volume, I want to just state for the record, was it your impression that in the time that you watched this transformation that the ramp up in volume was because of the refis?
No.
No?
It was always a refi market. That
okay.
was always the, until the bloody end. Now, near the end, it shifted a little, but until the very end, this was always about refinances,
okay.
not home purchases. FAMCO was probably 100% refis. I don't even think they did new purchase loans.
Okay.
You know, so Ameriquest was a lower percentage than that. But
right.
You know, no, the point was this. The point was Ameriquest was introducing extraordinary new volume to the business. You know, the volume in Ameriquest, you could just look at it and tell, oh, I've never seen. You know, we looked at the number one subprime lender, first with household, FAMCO, then with household, then with Ameriquest. And I'll tell you another way you notice the size of the volume here. With FAMCO, you know, we got $4,000 to $6,000 back per borrower. With the household, we got like $500 million, $484 million we split up, and we got, I think in Minnesota, we got like about $1,000 back per borrower, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not enough. In Ameriquest, one of the problems with settling the case was unless we were looking at a number north of $1 billion, because there were so many more loans, we would be getting a pittance back to people. You see, even if you settle for hundreds of millions of dollars, it doesn't matter because the volume is so much higher. So these are the two things that were put together that you could see or that I saw when we looked at the Ameriquest data. One was an investigation. One was we had moved from just high cost, deceptive, deceiving borrowers into taking high cost loans to massively imprudent lending. You know, these inflated appraisals, which you never saw, by the way, with FAMCO. They underwrote those loans. Those were underwritten loans. They didn't have inflated appraisals, stated income, all of that. You know, household either. They were underwriting those loans.
Right.
By Ameriquest, the underwriting was a joke. I mean, it was absurd. It was just fraud. There was just massive fraud in the underwriting, and imprudence in the underwriting. So that's one point, and the second point was volume. Well, you put those two things together, and that's why in 05, when I was trying to get a higher settlement amount or just to get them sued,
mm-hmm.
You know, I made this little speech, which you'll find in Mike's book, One Quote From, about this industry is going to collapse. And when it does, it's going to take down the American economy, or we're going to take a huge hit, and everyone's going to look at this. This is going to be a big damn deal.
Just a second.
When this thing collapses. And I want us, and I was trying to bolster the hawks here, I want you to think about how you want to be seen when this thing collapses. I want you to hold your head up and say you did everything you could to stop this industry. And, you know, here's our stand. You know, we've gone through FAMCO, we've gone through household, we gotta stop these. It's just getting worse. The volume's getting higher, the practices are deteriorating, you know, this thing is a mess. And you could, I mean, you didn't take a genius. You know, if you put all that together, you could see that this just involved, you know, such a large number of loans so poorly constructed that it was going to just collapse. It was going to collapse. And when it did, all that Wall Street funding was at risk, and it was just going to be a disaster. So you know, I kind of put all that together. I kind of used that to try to motivate the people to take a strong stand against Ameriquest. My preference would have been just to sue them. So that, and with all our lights blazing and all the AG, you know, hoopla around it, just to try to call attention to how bad the practices were.
Right.
You know, so that's kind of the story that I remember with Ameriquest. Did you guys have, does that answer your questions that you've never asked as I've been rambling?
No, it's great. It's a really fascinating story. When did you, how about Roland Arnall? What did you... did you ever have any contact with him?
I met Roland Arnall at this famous dinner. Have you heard about the dinner?
No.
Okay. This a write-up of the dinner occurs in Mike's book, but it also occurs in Bethany McLean.
Yes.
And Joe Nicora's book. Are you
yes.
familiar with their
yes,
book?
Yes, yes. Well, it's hard to get. We just got a copy of it recently because it isn't available for sale yet.
Oh, okay, I forgot about that.
But Prentice, you're one of the you're one of the few privileged people that's getting all these things in advance.
Well, I didn't get Bethany's book, but she sent me the section where she writes about stuff that I was involved in, right?
Yes.
Okay, so In both those books, they'll write about this dinner, and here's what happened. And again, it's not exactly right, but I'll give you the real, my version of the reality of it.
Okay.
We were out there meeting in Orange County with AmeriQuest. And, you know, we went out there and we had these, you know, Arab-Israeli peace negotiations where, you know, on one side of the table were 15, you know, a couple of attorney generals and 12 or 14 AATs. And on the other side of the table was AmeriQuest, their in-house counsel, their some of their operating people, their Tom Noto, who, by the way, is just a very nice, warm and person who actually did a very good job representing AmeriQuest by being, you know, as straightforward as he could be under the circumstances. And they had maybe, I don't know, half a dozen former AATs there from different states. I remember Indiana, Nevada, various places. They have these former AAGs on their side. So, you know, hard.
So we're on the AmeriQuest side.
Yeah. Okay. All these former AAGs.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we had a couple of meetings out in Orange County, and then we had one meeting in Chicago. And that was kind of our settlement, you know. But when we were out in Orange County, I think the second time we were out there, and things were kind of falling apart. And we had this sort of blow up in the morning that I was involved in, not a high point of my life. And so, you know, so we go back to our hotel and we get the word, and I don't remember from who, that AmeriQuest has invited us out for dinner to come talk further over this dinner. And I'm like, I don't want to go to dinner with AmeriQuest. You know, it's, I didn't like that idea, you know? So, and that Roland Arnall would be there. And I'm like, you know, I'll tell him to come to his goddamn conference room tomorrow, you know? It's like, there's something about going to dinner. So we get in this, like, minibus that they send for us. We're, of course, state employees, so we're staying in some crappy motel near the Angel Stadium. And they send this little minibus around, and we all pile into this minibus that AmeriQuest has sent to get us, right? And they take us to this, you know, this Orange County fancy restaurant. I mean, the food wasn't bad, mostly just pretentious. And so they take us to this restaurant, we go into this private dining room. And there is Roland Arnall, who stands and greets each of us as we come into the room and shakes our hand. And he's there with all of his top management. And so we all sit down, and they strategically placed us all at tables so that, you know, I was at a table with Tom Noto. I was sitting right next to Tom Noto, the general counsel, and at our table was this former Nevada AG, this woman, and, you know, various people like that. And so we're all in these different little tables.
So they split you up.
What?
They split you up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, you get it. And I'm like, I hate this. And I lean over to Tom Noto, and I sort of basically say, I don't like this, Tom. And he looks at me, and he didn't even say anything. I just lean over to start to say something. He says, I want to let you know. He could tell I was seething. And I want to let you know this wasn't my idea. And I said, good. You know? It's like, I hate this, you know. It's like, no, we're adversaries. This is not a sit down and be friendly. And I think of these people as basically, you know, early 21st century robber barons. You know, I just have contempt for what they're doing, okay?
Yeah.
And I don't want to sit down and have dinner with them. And, I mean, Tom Noto I'll sit down and have dinner with, but, you know, not these guys. So Roland Arnall gets up, and he makes this speech about how, you know, this isn't, you know, he's sorry for some of the things that have happened. This isn't the high standards his company has. This is the equivalent to me of passing out the best practices, right? You know, just complete bullshit, ignore it. And then he has each of his top executives go around and say how sorry they are for the mistakes that have been made.
No.
And so, yeah. And then and in the middle of these speeches, I'm so pissed off. They have wine sitting out there. I'm like, I don't want to hear it. So I get up and start pouring wine for people. You know, rather ostentatiously. Would you like some wine? Would you like some wine? I just want to say, you know, F you. I don't want to hear these apologies. I'm sorry, but it was just too contrived, and it's over this fancy meal. It just didn't feel right. okay? It
yeah.
just didn't feel right. There are times when that would be fine with an opposing party, particularly if it's just the opposing counsel, right? But it just didn't feel right. And in retrospect, I feel the same way. I haven't changed my mind about that. And so then they go around, they do this. You know, one of the people there, and I think both books probably write this, so one of the people there is Deval Patrick, who's now the governor of Massachusetts, who was on the board at AmeriQuest. And Deval comes around to
whose side is he? He's on the AmeriQuest side, right?
Yeah. He's there for AmeriQuest, you know. Oh, well, he's just another former AG there for AmeriQuest. You know, it's just, they're all former AGs there for AmeriQuest. You know, so he comes around and, you know, he's better dressed than any person I've ever met in my entire life. You know, he's just perfectly put together. And he comes around and shakes everyone's hand and does a little thing. So it's just a little sideshow. You know, but that's it. And then we have this dinner and then they bust us back. And, you know, when it was all done, I asked for a bill. And I, just to correct the record, I'm the only one who asked for a bill at the beginning. Then we kept having meetings, and I kept asking for a bill, not from them, but Tom Miller was talking to them. And I said, tell me how much it was. I'm going to pay them back. I don't feel comfortable having been to that dinner. They never would tell me, so I sent them a check for $50. And then after I sent the check for $50, I get word back, no, it was really $90. I sent him another check for $40, and I sent Tom Noto, like, either a note or an email, I don't remember, that said, next time you come here, I'm treating at Burger King. You know?
What do you think they thought the utility of that kind of hospitality was going to be?
Oh, it was just, you know, it's part of their, you know, we're contrite, we're sorry, we're a good company that's trying to do better, and we're going to make you feel good. You know, it's the same reason people always take their business, you know, people they're trying to get business from to dinner, right? You know, it just makes you see them as human beings and stuff like that.
Did it make you think that this was how AmeriQuest typically did business, is with sort of whining and dining people to get their way?
I don't know. I really, my only reaction to it is, I hate these bastards. Okay, I hate what they're doing in their company. I had a real clear sense of what they were doing in their company, and I thought, and I hated their business model, and I hated what they were doing, and I thought a dinner with people like that was just inappropriate, and so that's my personal reaction. I didn't care if this is how they did it. I don't care if they take their suppliers or their Wall Street people out for dinner at this place. You know, this overpriced, pretentious place. And I'm a foodie, so, you know, if it's good food, great. But, you know, I mean, it was like, it's like, I didn't want it. I didn't want that. But that's just like an anecdote of what happened in this process. It's really not that important.
What about...
The bottom line is AmeriQuest was infused with fraud and rampantly imprudent lending practice combined with massive volume.
Can I ask you?
I'm sorry, you said infused with fraud. Rampant.
And patent, let's say patently imprudent lending, underwriting and lending practices.
You had
no rational person would put their money behind a loan if they understood that this is what the loan looked like.
And massive volume, you said too, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And you combine
no
that
prudent
with
person would do this.
Unbelievable volume, which they got through, and we did get this, by the way, at the time, which they got through a sales culture that was pumped on steroids. They had an extraordinarily high pressure sales environment that, by talking to the former employees, we were able to get a sense of, as well as you could get it from the documents.
You had mentioned a little earlier that you had seen the risk inherent in this business. You saw the tie-in to Wall Street. So on the one hand, you wanted to win with them, but on the other hand, were you worried that they themselves were going to be their own destruction, that they would implode?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, you know what their defense was? Here was their defense. Their defense was we don't have the money. So I said, let's settle for $1 billion or sue them, right?
Right.
Because we get $1 billion, that gets everyone's attention, right?
Yeah.
If we sue them, we get to just call out all the practices in detail. I said, let's not, we're not going to settle for chump change here. We're not going to settle for less than household or even household amount. We have to settle for a huge amount, or more importantly, let's just sue them. At one point, I just said, this isn't worth it. Let's just sue them and see if, and like, this is accurately quoted. I said, let's step on the neck of the subprime industry. Let's do everything we can to just put this thing out of business. This is just out of control, you know? And this is the largest company, and if we can just put them out of business, let's do it. Let's scare Wall Street, you know? Let's just scare everybody. Anybody we can, let's just, you know, as much of an alarm as we can set off, let's set it off. And hopefully people will look at this and go, oh my God, that's where my money's going? We don't want that. So that was kind of my strategy in my head, was just, what can we do to get these people out of business? No more settlements. Which I think FAMCO, to answer your question, yes, their defense was, we don't have the money. In fact, at one point when I had a smaller meeting with Noto, he picked the keys out of his pocket and threw them on the table. And he said, take it. There's nothing here. There's nothing here. What are you going to do? You're going to take the building? You're going to take a bunch of computers? We don't have anything. You know, and Bass, Adam Bass, you know, the nephew, I think, or son-in-law or something, some relation to Arnall, you know, was there. And I said, we're going to go after Arnall. You know, and that's what Chuck Cross really pushed. And Chuck, that was, you know, my thing was we got to do all of blaring. Chuck's thing was we got to go after Arnall. He was right, too. I mean, we were supporting each other.
So when they, you know, when they tried to make it clearer to you that there wasn't anything there, you were dubious?
No, I think they were right.
Okay.
I mean, you know, that was because at that point I got the business model.
Mm-hmm.
The business model was to make a boatload of money and just drain it all out immediately. And so we'd gotten their financials, and I knew that Roland Arnall had drained billions out of this company. Right?
Right.
So I'm like, let's follow the money back. Somebody got the money, and I think it's Arnall and his family, so let's go after the money.
So where do you think the money is now?
It's Roland Arnall and his family. Although my cousin tells me that he lost it all in some terrible oil investment, or a chunk of it. But, you know, he took after tax, he took billions out of that company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least $1.5 billion, probably.
Well, he also spent a lot of money.
No, I'm talking about personally.
No, I know, but he also spent a lot of money personally in Washington.
Yeah, like giving it to George Bush and stuff. Yeah, and, you know, Schwarzenegger and Gray Davis. Yeah, no doubt. He spent a lot of money. But I'm just saying, he had a lot of money, and his family had a lot. You know, I mean, there was a lot of money drained out of that company, and Chuck's view was to go after it, and Chuck was right. I mean, that was one strategy. I mean, I think we should have sued AmeriQuest, and we should have sued the officers of the owners of AmeriQuest who drained the money out of it.
Why did you settle?
Mm-hmm.
Why did you settle?
Settle?
Yeah, why did you take the settlement?
I left to come to the U, and it settled after I left.
Oh, so you were gone.
When I left, I think the Hawks kind of fell apart. So, you know, I didn't want to settle. And if we settled, I wanted to settle for an eye-popping amount. And again, by that point, I saw this suit in the context of the whole subprime mortgage industry. In fact, there's a good quote in Mike's book that is absolutely, totally accurate, where somebody on the other side, I think it was their outside counsel or one of the former AGs, said, Prentice, on a bad day, you would say everyone in the subprime industry is a fraud or something like that. And I looked at him, I said, I would say that on a good day.
Mm, yeah.
You know?
Right.
I mean, it's like, that industry was just, it didn't matter what rock you turned over. It just didn't matter.
One of the interesting things that you've said is how clear it was if anyone had wanted to look at the documentation.
Exactly.
Can you help us think through, in that time period, who you think may have seen the documentation and knew, but just didn't really want to say? Someone with authority to have done something, perhaps, to have acted, but did not?
The problem was, as you no doubt know from your work, the problem was the regulatory structure. The problem was that AmeriQuest was a non-bank, and there was no one. Well, I think the answer to your question has to be, you know, the same question everyone is asking, which is, why did investors put money into this kind of thing, right?
Right.
And I'm starting, my first point is going to, why didn't the regulators find it? And the answer was, there really weren't regulators looking at safety and soundness, because these were non-banks, so they weren't regulated for safety and soundness. Right?
Right, right.
So we were there as AGs, which is astounding. Why are AGs there? You know how many staff I had at the AG's office? At the high point, I think I had me and seven attorneys. At mm-hmm. the low point, I tend to have like four. So it fluctuated between like five and eight people in the division. Now, this is an AG, and none of us, and I was the only one who made six figures, and I made exactly 100,000 or something. Okay?
Yeah.
Right. When I left, or 102.
Right.
And I was probably the highest paid AAG in the country, or close to it. Okay? So, look at that for research. Now, remember, subprime mortgage is just one thing that basically I did. And, you know, we were going after, you know, auto problems. I did this whole series of cases on foreclosure frauds, starting in 03, 04, which led to passing this law that's now, you know, gotten around dealing with people in foreclosure with equity at the time. You know what I mean? Foreclosure,
yes.
Equity stripping.
Right.
And we were doing a series of cases about that. Auto dealers, health insurance. I mean, we had this huge range of work we were doing with almost no staff.
Yes.
But in this
case, why were state AGs taking the lead with just a couple of financial regulators like Washington? Why were state and Chuck Cross, why were state AGs taking the lead here? That's absurd.
So we can.
I mean, there was no regulatory structure, and it was only because state AGs step into voids where there is no adequate regulation, and that's what was happening in this case. But we only had a UDAP hammer. We didn't have regulatory authority. Who should have been looking at these files? One would hope the Federal Reserve Board would obtain this kind of information in making decisions about how to use its broad regulatory authority under HOPA. That didn't happen. One would hope that the OCC would be going back when their banking entities were buying mortgage-backed securities and involved in all aspects of the business, like servicing and the trust and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
They would be, you know, maybe doing some supervision to determine, you know, whether the securities that were being created and purchased by their entities had, you know, really were what they thought they were, at least some spot checking on that. The OTS deserved its death penalty, and that's like that little thing I sent you about meeting with the OCC. I mean, we figured out by 2001 that the OCC was captive of the bank industry and was actually opposing state attorney general's attempt to work on fraud and deception issues in banks. They were going to stand between us and the banks. This is exactly what they did. And the case I went to talk that motivated me to put together that group to talk to Julie Williams, they actually wound up filing an amicus against us.
And can you give us an explanation from your vantage point of why they opted to go that direction?
Sure, I know. I have a very clear sense of why they went that way, because they were selling federal banking charters to banks. It's a charter competition. And in fact, the prior, not Hawk, but the guy before Hawk, said to the Wall Street Journal, I'm not ashamed to sell preemption as a benefit of a federal charter. They would go to banks and tell banks, yeah, charter with us. We'll protect you from the state AGs, and who else out there is gonna go after you? I mean, you know, the state AGs were the ones they were afraid of.
Yeah, I'm
right?
Sorry, I don't remember that quote from the Wall Street Journal that they were selling preemptions. Who said that?
Who was the guy before Hawk? What's his name?
Dugan?
Yeah, that's okay. Here, in fact, it's in a little symposium piece I wrote. It's not exactly brilliant, but it cites Kathleen Keast and Amy, what's-her-name's brilliant piece on these issues. Let me write this to you, Kirsten. Let me just send you this little symposium piece I published in the Pace Law Review, and just search for Dugan, and
okay.
You'll see the Wall Street Journal quote.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And again, it goes along with that Dodd thing that I sent you. It was obvious what was happening.
How did you feel about this?
I hate to sound like such a lunatic, but it's outrageous. You've got a federal agency that we're going to and saying, hey, your banks are involved in this fraud. That was the pre-acquired account marketing thing. And I'm going to send you a copy of my article on pre-acquired account marketing.
Right.
All the data showing this is just, it's still going on, by the way. And the biggest customers are still the banks. So nothing's changed, all right?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to them saying, your banks are involved in these blatant frauds. You want to help us, right? Then we want to help you. And I was kind of hoping they'd go, wow, you're right. This is really terrible conduct. Why don't you give us what you got, and we'll tell you what we have, and let's share enforcement here. And instead, we got this lecture from Julie Williams, who waited till we all filed in, and then all her staff was there, and then came in and talked to us in these very quiet tones about the special place that banks have in the federal system. And basically, and I'm now making this up, basically you are people to be quashed,
mm-hmm.
because you're challenging our exclusive authority over banks, and states don't even have the authority to enforce their own laws against banks. That was the 2000, that was the visitorial powers rule, which was overturned in the Clearinghouse versus Cuomo versus Clearinghouse case. But it hadn't passed the rule yet, but that was already their position. So it's outrageous. I mean, here we have a federal agency that should be, oh my gosh, bank customers, the people we're ultimately supposed to be protecting, are being defrauded by these banks. We have to get right on this. Instead, it was all about the banks and all about how we had no authority, and you just tell us what you know, and we may or may not tell you what we did. You have no right to be looking at banks, you have no right to be talking to them, and you have no right to sue, even for state law violations, even where you're not preempted.
You have no
enforcement right, because we have exclusive enforcement authority.
Were you able to communicate your sense of outrage and reactions higher up the chain? Was there anyone that you could go to who would listen?
We went pretty much to the top. I mean, Julie Williams was Dugan and Hawk's general counsel and right-hand arm, right?
Right.
You know?
What about justice?
Look, again, I'm going to go back. Put yourself in our position. It's not my job to straighten out the banking regulatory structure.
Right.
I got way too much on my plate.
Right.
To take on straightening out the regulatory structure. I complained to anybody that would listen. I will tell you that.
No, I was also thinking that maybe you got their attention so that you didn't necessarily, have to. Maybe they called. Maybe they were interested. Maybe they, approached you. That didn't happen.
No.
Okay.
No, the next time I got approached by the OCC was when we sue Fleet Mortgage,
mm-hmm.
and Andy Sandler, I want to say, their guy, Skadden Arps, who's defending it.
Mm-hmm.
Andy tells me early on, he says, well, the OCC is going to intervene on our behalf. And I'm like, well, good for you, Andy. And if you can get the OCC, I don't doubt it, after talking to Julie Williams. And he told me, before they filed their, they wound up filing amicus, not intervening, but he told me before they filed their amicus brief that they were going to file their amicus brief.
So the case was
they never called me. I mean, they never called us and said, we're going to file an amicus against you. They saw their clients and the people they worked for as the banks, and they talked to the bank's lawyers, not us, which is outrageous.
Right.
They saw us as competitors to be squashed, basically,
right.
by their claims of exclusive authority and preemption, which are two sides of the coin.
So would you say that, in your opinion, the OCC is p- partially responsible for the collapse of the housing market?
Partially. I really think the ultimate problem, the number one problem in my opinion, is that we allowed a non-bank, we allowed an alternative financial services industry, in mortgages and other areas, but I'm most familiar with mortgages, we allowed an alternative financial services industry to develop outside of our regulatory structures. So that was by far the number one problem. I don't I don't think that, and did the banks participate in that system and then ultimately start to copy it and become a significant part of the problem? Yes. It did not originate, and it was not primarily a problem of the banks or the banking regulatory system, but they were serious players. And more importantly, not only were they negligent, they were aggressive players to attempting to stop any enforcement action that dealt with the banking, that dealt with the bank's participation in the conduct. So when we looked at targets, we had to avoid banks, knowing that if we went to a bank, we were going to wind up having all these extra costs of trying to fight off the OCC, and we would probably lose. And so we had to wait till those issues got resolved through the case that was ultimately Cuomo. I had a better test case, but wasn't able to bring it. You know, we were fighting the OCC on another front, and while that fight was going on, we had to avoid going after banks. So we couldn't really look at them because we knew we'd be tied up in court on the jurisdiction and enforcement powers issue. And why in the world was that the case? I mean, those guys should have been on our side. They should have been calling us, going, "Wow, you guys are a lot more on the ground than we are. What do you know?
Right.
What do you know? You know?
Right.
I mean, and that's this little small PACE article I wrote basically says, if you trace what happened in the financial system, why were the state AGs the only ones who did anything about this? And I think one of the answers is that, you know, our agencies listened to consumers, and we paid attention to consumer complaints, and we took them seriously, and we used them as evidence of systemic problems, whereas the OCC basically doesn't, you know, have a consumer complaint system. They discourage consumer complaints, in the words of Kathleen Keyes. And they don't use that as a vital piece of information. They aren't very interested in that. And that's a flaw. That's a problem. They should have been cooperating with us. And instead they were competing with us. I'm going to make a copy of this thing. I found it that Deb Hagen sent me. Let's see what that says. I'm just going to send it as I've got it, which references that meeting took place, if you want this.
Yes.
That meeting took place on May 9th, 2001, the one with Julie Williams that I've been talking to you about.
Okay.
2001?
2001.
Oh, early.
Early. That's what I'm saying. It was over another issue. It was over this pre-acquired account marketing issue.
Wow.
But, you know, that's where we went in trying to say, hey, you know, be our friends. Help us.
But in 2001, they were being turfy, and yet as the bubble rose, inflated, and problems got bigger and worse and more evident, you're saying they still stayed very turfy.
Oh, to the bloody end.
Right.
I mean, to the bloody end, until recently. You know, very recently, the OCC started to change. But, you know, until the bloody end, all they cared about was banks. They did not care. They saw us as enemies.
Wow.
Until, you know, through the entire thing. You know, it was very bad.
Were there any interesting dimensions that we should think of about how this kind of migrated state to state and how this
I'm sorry, let me back up. And in this, you'll see a memo to the consumer staff from Debbie Hagen, the chief of the consumer division,
mm-hmm.
That attaches the memo from the OCC, and then at the bottom, Debbie says, of course, after she says the OCC has said you should refer your complaints to us, and then at the bottom she says, of course, We could choose to pursue an investigation against the National Bank within the office. However, we should consider the fact that the OCC may intervene against us. Get it? In other words, we can do this, but understand with our very limited resources, they're going to tie us up.
Right.
So, anyway, go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, were there any interesting dimensions of this period of time that you're describing that we should think about as state by state, how they gamed it from state by state, or any interesting dimensions of trying to skirt regulatory supervision state by state?
When you say they, who do you mean?
AmeriQuest.
Oh, AmeriQuest. Well, you know about the Georgia thing, right?
No, I'm sorry, I don't. Probably Kirsten does.
I know about it a little. I know about it somewhat, but I'd like to hear what you have to say.
There was actually also predatory lending law here. And let me give you another name. And, you know, Jordan has hit on hard times. He was Acorn's local person, but then he later became Acorn's national housing justice person. And Jordan and Acorn, despite that their reputation, ran a very sophisticated, very effective help for homeowners who were caught in predatory loans. He was involved in a 2001. No, let me back it up. When would it have been? 2002, I think. A 2002 legislative attempt to pass a state predatory lending law here, and AmeriQuest came in at the last minute. Their lobbyists came in and killed it. And Jordan can kind of give you the background on that.
Okay.
I don't know who else was involved in that. It may have been Ron Elwood, my friend at the Legal Services Advocacy Project here. And, you know, but he may have been come later, so I'm not sure. Put a question mark there. The real battle that everyone talks about that really defined this was a Georgia law where the state of Georgia, and it was the old governor, Sonny Perdue, you know, before he became governor, he was like a small town banker or something. It's, you know, typical. My mother ran the DeKalb County Library System in Georgia, and I'm Southern, so I can say this. You know, he's one of these typical, you know, Southern redneck small town bankers, and he, you know, but he got involved with some of the subprime lending. I forget which some of the early cases. The guy named Bill Brennan, a famous, wonderful legal aid lawyer down in Atlanta, kind of, you know, got him involved in it, and he saw the light and said, "Oh my God, this is horrible." Before he became governor, and was involved in some legal challenges that were successful. And then when he became governor, he spearheaded a state anti-predatory lending law that included a provision, an assignee liability provision. Do you know what I mean by that?
No, go.
So that the securitization system would retain the liability of the originator for any fraud or problems with the loan.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So they understood, it was very sissy, and they understood that, you know, once you made Wall Street accountable for the conduct of the originator, they weren't going to be funding these guys, right?
Right.
And so they passed that law, and all hell broke loose, and the rating agencies, and the OCC and the OTS all went down, all came out with, you know, basically said we aren't going to write loans and, you know, the warning about not writing loans in Georgia, and at a critical time when they were kind of, when a new Republican governor came in and they were trying to overturn the bill, you know, all the rating agencies and the federal banking regulators came in and basically threatened Georgia that their mortgage market was going to collapse if they didn't overturn this bill. So this was not neglect on the part of the federal banking regulators, and it wasn't neglect on the part of the rating agencies. They were actively involved in making sure that the legal structures insulated Wall Street and banks from the consequences of the fraudulent and, you know, improved lending that was happening on the origination.
Yeah, when did the Georgia thing happen, Prentice?
I want to say it was 03, but...
We can check.
You can check that. I want to say it was like 03, 04... 05, it's somewhere in, it's 03, it was earlier, so it's probably 03, 04.
Yeah.
It wasn't like the end, you know, like we passed a huge predatory lending law here in early 07, but that was just catching the very tail end of the problem. By the time it went into effect, August 1, 07, the the industry collapsed. So we kind of got in right at the bell, you know, at the end. You know, we were the first state to pass. Ohio was the first, and then we passed another big anti-predatory lending law, you know, after, you know, we were the two states that passed them and didn't repeal them, but they were both too late. North Carolina, that's the second generation. The first generation was based on the North Carolina law. So they were like the lead state on that. But Georgia, really, I mean, that was an awesome law, and it would have had a huge impact on the industry, and they knew it, and that's why they went down there, and all the national players went down and got it overturned, with help from the rating agencies and the banking regulators. This is not a pretty story.
You're describing to us, you know.
I'm describing abuse of power. Conflict of interest and abuse of power. That's exactly what I'm describing. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. And then when it blew up, and you had watched it get ready to blow up for a long time, what did you think?
I thought very sadly, I told you so.
Yeah.
And in fact, for several reporters who I'd been haranguing about this for years, about how this was going to collapse, and my colleagues around here that I'd been haranguing, I suppose I should have written the article that made me look brilliant, but I never put it in paper. But, you know, everyone basically came back and said, boy, you must feel like I told you so. And, you know, I did, but who cares? I mean, you know, who cares? I mean, here's a line I want you to get because I use it all the time, which is, this was a disaster before it was a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, like, to me, the number one lesson out of this. This was a disaster for homeowners and particularly working class and minority homeowners, but certainly way beyond that. This was a disaster for homeowners and working people before it was a financial crisis. Nobody gave a friend a cuss. Nobody gave a shit about this when it was just a disaster for those people. But it was a disaster for those people. And nobody cared at all. Once it became a financial crisis, then you can't stop having, I just spent my day at the Law Review Academic Forum about, you know, the financial crisis, right?
Right.
I mean, it's like everyone has to have endless papers and seminars, et cetera, about the financial crisis. I mean, but what's lost in there is that even if we'd never had a financial crisis, this was a disaster for people. You know, millions of people, you know, were going to get thrown out of their homes eventually. You know, and so, I mean, I could see the financial implications of this early on in 05, you know, that this was going to be an economic disaster. I didn't realize it'd be this big, you know what I mean?
Right.
But, I mean, I got that this could be huge, you know, a huge economic financial crisis problem. But really, it doesn't matter. What matters is we should have been caring about this because the financial system was predacious. And was causing massive distress with the most important financial asset Americans have, and putting everyone's homes at risk. And what we've got now is we've got a system where even when you're not in default, we have introduced this incredibly large element of risk into many people's financial lives because of these mortgage instruments that pushed high LTVs and stated incomes and teaser rates and exploding rates and all of that. We put all this risk into the system that caused damage to people's lives, totally apart from the collateral damage that was caused to the economy and employment and all those things that's now become the entire focus of the discussion. And so how does your question that I think you guys need it, is how does the regulatory system not only solve the financial crisis problem, but how does the regulatory system pay attention to the consequences of the financial service industries on people's lives? And it had a huge negative impact on people's lives long before it was a financial crisis. People should have been outraged about this lending. And only the advocacy community was. And they should have been outraged about this lending long before it was a crisis. And I'll say one more thing about that may, you know, I still feel this way in the way I'm going to tell you now, which is all these talking heads that come on that are now all the experts about this,
mm-hmm.
Where the hell were they when this was going on? you know? Mm-hmm. And it was foreseeable. It was predictable, and it was preventable.
Just a second.
Which, by the way, is something I told the USA Today reporter, and they stole and put on a headline, but back in, like, 07. But it was predictable, and it was preventable. And you know, all the people who are now having all the seminars about how to solve this problem with all the theories, you know, if you're on the ground looking at people's lives, that's a critical part of the data. Now, I do both. I think it's also important to understand the numbers and to understand the systems and all of that. But you don't really understand all of that unless you look and see what's going on in people's lives on the ground. And you have to go back and forth between those two sources of knowledge to really understand what's happening. And if you have this theory of the market and how the market works, you better go and look at people's lives and the problems people are having and see to what extent that actually matches what happens with your theory of the market.
Would you talk a little bit about that issue about the theory of the market? You know, you've talked about how the OCC felt like it was its job to protect the banks, its clients. But let's go to this issue of the ideological underpinnings of all this, too. And that seems to be what you're touching here, is that there was some sort of belief that the free market was self-regulating.
Yeah, it wasn't some sort of belief. It was the expressed philosophy of almost all politicians and regulators. I mean, Exhibit A, Alan Greenspan's statements about you don't have to worry about these things because the market will self-adjust. Exhibit B, the OTS and other regulators with the chainsaw, right? I mean, these aren't hidden problems. It takes no research to find that the prevailing ethos in regulators and politicians and in the academy was, you know, all about the market, and this is all about market efficiency. And any attempt to regulate was just imposing costs. You know, it's to me a silly, childish political philosophy that Americans share with almost no one in the world.
Just a second.
You know? You're just getting all my radical rant. But, you know, I mean, it's like, I consider myself kind of like a European moderate, right? Kind of a conservative social democrat. But in America, that position is considered radical. We have a ideological perspective that shifts way to the right. So the liberals are basically center-right positions in the rest of the world. And then we have a far-right position of, you know, economic libertarianism that no substantial chunk of people subscribe to in any developed country in the world.
Well, this is one of the things that was really interesting, is that one of the things that's apparent is, do you think that the Democrats, if they'd been in charge, would have done this any differently? I mean, because, you know, I mean, now
no.
we do have a...
The answer to your question is slightly, but not really. And the evidence for that is two things. Number one, look at the Clinton years. I mean, it was not... Clinton and the Republicans on financial regulation issues were the same, essentially. They were all deregulatory. They all believed in the market. They all were very tight with, and more importantly, they looked at the world from the perspective of the lending institutions and the giant financial institutions in the country. Exhibit two, Tim Geithner's Treasury Secretary. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're asking about now my political views, not my factual recounting of history, okay?
Well, except that you were in a position to observe things that most people were not.
Well, that's true. But I think the fact that you know, they bring in someone like Tim Geithner, you know, it tells you, you know, you could tell right away. I mean, I knew immediately, you know, when they brought in Tim Geithner. Oops. You know, this is somebody who came from these regulators that look at the world through the lens of the largest financial companies, service companies in America. That's their perspective on the world. They've never looked at the world from the point of view of a working family that's got a credit card and has credit card debt and is trying to manage that with a mortgage and what financial products look like to those people. And until you get somebody who also has an appreciation, you need both. You also have to have an appreciation for what the people who are consuming or using these financial products, how the world looks to them. And, you know, you don't have that. And that's why we spent X trillion dollars supporting the financial services industry in its crisis. You know, and then we demanded nothing to set up effective, consistent programs that could help homeowners that would in turn stabilize the real estate market. I mean, the analogy I say is our carrot stick approach for the financial services companies when we bailed them out was a boatload of carrots and two toothpicks. We just demanded nothing of them. And it's outrageous to me. I mean, it is outrageous. We should have said, okay, we're bailing you out, and if ideologically we can't nationalize you, which is the obvious thing to do, then you're going to write loan modifications, and here's what it's going to look like. You will write permanent loan modifications to people who meet these criteria, and the criteria are going to be designed to keep the most number of people in their homes possible, thereby keeping houses off the market, thereby preventing the depression of real estate prices and this downward negative cycle that's been going on for years. And again, I've been talking about all this stuff for years. I'm not just saying this stuff in retrospect. It was obvious at the beginning that it is. The key was to keep all those homes off the market because, one, that was a fair thing to do, and, two, it was consistent with stability in the real estate market. You couldn't save everybody, and you don't even want to save the investors. I'm just talking about owner-occupied, and even there, you can't save everybody. Some people are way too underwater and have no ability to support remotely the kind of loan that was necessary. But what you need to do is identify who you can save and save them permanently because it benefits us all to do that. And that was never demanded of the finance. Nothing was demanded of them.
What about this latest twist with the fact that the documents are so flawed that no one really knows who has the notes? And
which is, I'm going to answer that and tell you I have to go because I have to go talk on our local public TV Friday night policy channel for people with no life about this issue, okay?
Okay.
The answer is, why would you possibly be surprised that an industry that had no-doc loans and inflated appraisals and all that thing, all those kinds of things, would, when it came time to foreclose, you know, invent documents? Why would anybody be surprised? There's been no change, nothing demanded of those industries to fundamentally change who they are. So I gotta go.
Wait. I'm sorry. Something really, really important. One more question. Lisa,
yes.
Madigan, what was her role with the whole thing?
She's wonderful. She came in later, though.
Yeah.
She came in later. She's wonderful. Debbie Hagan is her chief aide and has been worked on these issues. And Tom James, the one I gave you the number for, is Lisa's employee, and she's a breath of fresh air.
Do you have any recollection about her at all? See, she testified to us, and so one of the things that we need to try to do in our report is tie in individuals as much as possible who publicly testified to us.
Well, her office, you can talk to Tom James about all their work, but her office led the national investigation against FAMCO, which we weren't part of because we settled, remember? But, you know, her office was involved way back at FAMCO, was in the leadership with Household and the leadership with Ameriquest. Her office was there for the whole set of cases, and she is an incredibly great advocate on these issues. I got to go, though. You're welcome to call me back next week, or you got
okay.
My cell phone number. You can
thank
call me this
you.
Weekend if you really want to talk.
Thanks a lot. Thanks.
Yeah.
Good luck with your talk.
You.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.